This is Ben Crenshaw. You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
I'm going to keep the
absolutely.
TV if it's all right.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, good evening, good night, good morning, wherever you are. We are live with Mr. Ron Pritchard, watching the early stages of round four of the 2026 PGA Championship at Aronimink. Of course, Ron, that you had obviously a lot to do with. First of all, thank you for joining us. And what are your thoughts when you watch this? Before we get into some of the details of what happened, since you have redesigned it, and then Gil Hanse came along, and but what strikes me, and maybe we'll start here, is that it's, and I've been watching golf majors. I haven't missed a golf major on TV since 1982. It's really other than the Open. One of the first events in the United States where it strikes me that it reminds me that golf is two games, one tee to green and then around the green and on the green. And these greens at Aronimink and what the players deal with, to me, it's such a beautiful sight to see. Would that be a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm having the time of my life. I can tell you that Gil Hanse's participation on the golf course was the was really rebunkering the golf course. And I don't want to get into it too much because I'm not in favor of what he did. Did I send you a long podcast?
Yes, you did. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I don't remember the name of the podcast, but it was a beautiful a talk that you had with the guy who was extremely knowledgeable. The bunkering is maybe another thing, but maybe if we can focus on the on just the green and
on the
long game and the short game.
The putting services are magnificent, and my role, you know, a significant part of my role was involving the putting services, but because what had happened in 1987, Robert Trent Jones was engaged by Aronimink to basically renovate their golf course, and I happened the first. I guess I had visited Aronimink, you know, quite a few years prior to 87, but I went to Aronimink almost by chance in 1987 and saw what Trent Jones was doing. Really disappointed me because what he did was on four or five holes, he just peeled away a big portion of the greens fill pad, which supported, you know, maybe a third of the putting surface, and he used all that fill to build mounding around the outside of his bunkering. He rebunkered the entire golf course. And I think I sent you my restoration plan. If I haven't, I will.
Yes, you did. You did.
Okay, so you can share that with any of your viewer, you know, your I'm going to say viewers, but maybe I mean listeners.
It's more listeners than viewers, and thank God for that.
Yeah, well, it really is rewarding because I can see on the back of number one where we really basically removed a big old maple tree that was probably 70 years old, right on a third of the fill pad, and then we had to do a lot of repair work to repair the damages, and then on three and on six and on 14 in particular, we had to do a lot of work on those, on the greens fill pads. But what I, you know, I, The restoration I did there was fairly simple. I didn't put a lot of undulation in it because it wasn't necessary, but they were sort of slender noses that we added back onto the greens. And I used Ross's original drawings of the, I mean, I have all of Ross's original drawings of every putting surface. So, I mean, I don't call what is on top of the greens fill pad a green. In all my studies and personally, I think the green is the entire structure of the. And on top of, I mean, I'm counting. I mean, the greenside bunkering, all the slopes, all the earth that supports a putting surface that sits on top. So that's why, you know, maybe sound a little different to your listeners that I don't refer to a green as the putting surface. Really, I think it leads to confusion, and I just think it's absolutely wrong. I mean, what people put on is the putting surface and the, as I said, the entire big old structure that you build to and cap off with a putting surface is what I talk about. So,
yeah.
But anyway, we did a lot of work, and they're basically 100 years old. These putting surfaces.
Is it? I mean, everybody keeps talking about, at least here on TV in Germany, how big these greens are. Is it necessary to have big greens to have these kind of, as you call, slender noses and the spines that run and give us these
No.
bowls that that they keep talking about for the pin positions?
No, I mean, one of the reasons you get the illusion is that they're very big is because the pins are pretty much at the edges of the putting surface, you know, which is on TV right now. And you know, the 15th green is a long par four as they play it. I think the members, well, I'm sure the members still play it as a four, but they play a more forward tee.
Right.
But that putting surface, according to Ross's drawings, was 8,800 square feet, which is pretty large, you know, for an American golf course. But Gil added about 30 feet in the back, which I kind of challenged him on. I just told him it was wrong. It wasn't what Ross did, and I sent him the drawing. So, but he doesn't really pay much attention to me. So.
What was his response to you?
Well, he doesn't respond.
You know, there you go. That's the German response. No answer is also an answer.
Yeah, he doesn't respond. Hey. You know, but I mean, it doesn't matter anyway. You know, I've done several things. I just explained, Gil, you're heading in the wrong direction here, and if you want to talk about it, you have my telephone number, which I'll give him anyway. And I mean, I don't have any ill will, but he's one of the of basically a new generation.
Yep.
And Gil's actually pretty cautious with some of the work that he does.
Yep.
So
yep.
He's not, but you yep. know, there's a variety of his approaches to things.
And
I mean, honestly, I'll just to make it. I would say the average green here is 6,500 square feet, which is not enormous.
But
so I don't know what they're doing. You know, by the way, this little house that they just showed on TV.
Right.
It's on the outside of the seventh hole. They wanted to tear that down. I battled for that. Some of the wooden eaves were damaged, and a lot of the purple martins used to nest under the eaves of that little white house, and so.
And it's still
you
standing.
Know, I successfully begged them to leave it alone. They
it's
did.
Still standing. Thank you for that. And you know,
yeah.
And we had a wonderful talk at the very beginning of our podcast back in 2020, I think it was, with you and Christian Althaus, one of our young architects, who is trying to protect, architecture the way, or the golf courses the way they were built. And then there was an interesting story, and it was also talked about in the podcast you did with this gentleman that I referred to earlier. There's the house. Now we see it in Germany, that White House. Donald Ross said at some point that this is my best piece of work, and this is the way I, you know, imagine it, blah, blah, blah. But there's a story that there was another gentleman who really did some work that Ross did not intend or did not plan for. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I mean, because I know Ross was there in the beginning, because there's a film clip that you can get on YouTube that shows Donald Ross walking around Aronimink, you know, but it was at the very early stages of construction. And I explained in that podcast, I'm pretty certain Ross didn't pay much attention to this golf course while it was being built, because J.B. McGovern, one of his associates, not only, he was a green chairman and a member at Aronimink. And so he was on site every day. He lived in Wynwood, which is only about 15 miles away from the golf course. So he was there every day, and he not only built the putting services, which I really commend him for, but he also built a lot of his bunkering. Just frankly, doesn't make any sense at all. But he had an affinity for multiple bunkers and clusters of bunkers rather than one big one. So, you know, and by the way, Derek Dunham he's the fellow that interviewed me on that podcast, and he's the golf architectural editor for Golf Digest here in the States. And I didn't know him until a couple of weeks ago. He called and contacted me, and he wanted to do a podcast. But he's very bright, very respectful, and extremely knowledgeable about the history of golf. You know, so that podcast is, you know, was fun for me to do. I did it only 9 days ago, 10 days ago, a week ago Friday, and he came out with it a week ago today. So it's very recent. But I mean, I think I would like everybody that can to listen to that. So
yes, and we will link it in our show notes. When Donald Ross said, you know, this is my best piece of work, was he being a gentleman?
I think he was. He came back. That I found out recently, Frank, that he. So I was. My thinking was always that maybe he said that on opening day, which, you know. But even then, you know, as I say in the podcast, I mean, if all the bunkering was done differently than he had sketched it, I mean, what could he do? You know, I mean. So he had to say it's fine, but he did get that. He didn't come back until 1948, shortly before he passed away. And that's when he made that statement, and the golf course had been finished in 1929. You know, so that's really 19 years after the golf course was finished. So
right. The podcast that you're referring to is called Feed the Ball, it's called The Wrap. Aronimink Heads or Tails with Ron Pritchard, and we encourage everyone to listen to it. It's a classic podcast, an hour and 40 minutes, and it's about what this game is really about. Let me ask you this, and just out of personal interest, when you as an architect lay out a course and you design it and everything, how much creative input does a shaper have to the golf course that you design?
I try to finish all my putting services by hand, Frank. I mean, it's, you know, it might take 4 days or 5 days. You know, you have, based on the USGA specifications, you should kind of replicate what you want your surface character to be at the subgrade elevation, but even the USGA has somewhat abandoned that since they first came out with specifications probably 30 years ago. So now there's a really, the handcuffs are off on what you do on the top of the ground. And but you know, I frankly That's what I've done. Nobody else does it that way. Everybody, it's just everybody else is in a hurry, and I know. I mean, I haven't built an enormous number of new golf courses, but at the Tournament Players Club in Memphis, where they play the FedEx St. Jude Championship
exactly
every year.
Yep.
I finished all the hands by green, but I finished all the putting surfaces by hand, and then went back to Texas. That golf course is in Memphis. And when I left the job, one fellow that I won't name got on every putting surface with a draft rake, with a drag, and he dragged out most of the topographic personality. So
right.
Obviously it broke my heart when I came back to see the golf course, but I, at that point, again, I wasn't going to redo it. And so I've only been back to Memphis one time,
yeah.
And that was last year. And the golf course really looked good. I mean, they haven't made a lot of changes, but I always will remember in the hot Memphis sun, all the work that I put in with about six or seven Latinos to hand rake all those
well,
greens,
I always remember the story you told me about you and your brother on the boat on the lake with the night vision goggles, whatever. You were hunting the frogs. I don't know what you were doing, but I think the fact that that many, many players and many of the best players in the world still call the TPC at Southwind one of their favorite tracks, I think says it all.
Thank you.
And that picture of you and Fuzzy Zeller, where I don't know what you were doing, but it sure looks like you were having a great time.
Fuzzy had a Budweiser in his hands.
Yeah, well, they cut that out of the photo. I mean, this was pre-Photoshop, but they managed to cut that out, and that's still.
I cut that out.
You cut it out. Well, it's still one of my favorite golf photographs of all time.
Thank you.
maybe one day you'll send me the original without the butt cut out. As you watch this tournament on TV and a major, and to me, one of my first thoughts was when I started watching it, and I don't obviously I've never played Arana Mink, but looking at this golf course, which to me is of course it's not a typical golf course you see on the PGA Tour every year,
right.
But my first thought was, if the PGA of America had any balls, they would make this a Ryder Cup golf course, because it seems to me like a match play golf course. Because that's really what Donald Ross and all the other architects of his area really—they were playing match play. They weren't playing 72 hole stroke play.
Right. And really, that was always fundamentally Ross's thought. Throughout his life, he went to his grave, really thinking from a match play point of view. So, I mean, he never put a par in any of the golf courses that he designed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find a routing plan hanging in any club in the United States where it tells you the par on individual holes or at the total line. So
there's no par.
There's just. Yep. I think that way. I get people asking me questions about that all the time. And in Ross's day, frankly, there were only one set of tee markers on his golf courses.
Right.
He might have had a couple. He might have had a couple teeing grounds on each hole, but normally it was one teeing ground, maybe fairly long in length, but just one set of blocks, and everybody played the same length that day.
Right.
Men, women, senior players, scratch players, and people don't know these things, but now hopefully everybody in Germany does.
Yeah, absolutely, because now we've got golf courses that have six, seven, eight sets of tees.
Exactly.
And God bless them. I mean, if it grows the game, fine, but I think the spirit of the game of everybody playing from the same peg, every day. That's what the designers, the great designers, really had in mind.
Well, there were a handful of the designers, but that was the thinking in the old days. But once it got over here, once people began to think of par, you know, we've created that sense of failure, and it's absolutely ridiculous, really. Yeah. But you know, then when I talk to people about it, they say, "Yeah, well, wrong. The speed of play is an issue. So if you had the women playing or senior men playing more, you know, back where the championship play is, or the back tees, you know, it would take forever." And
right.
I mean, that's a good point, but some of those things don't change my mind, you know. So. Yeah.
Can we talk about the bunkering here on Aronimink?
Yes.
I mean, they're talking, or did you know, big story, 174 bunkers, whatever, on the golf course. Was that the original design? Were there that many bunkers? No.
No. If you look at the routing plan that I sent you,
yep,
and you could share that with any of your members.
I will.
I mean, a big percentage of the trees have been taken down in the last 10 years at Aronimink.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest about it, they killed all the red oaks because they limbed up the oak trees at the wrong time of the year. There's only a 2 month window when you should even think about taking the bottom limbs off an oak tree, but they didn't know that, and so they limbed up the oak trees, and I was not consulted or really connected with the club at that time from 1918 on, and you should have a professional do that kind of work.
Right.
So they lost about 100 magnificent oak trees, and then they've taken down the majority of their other trees, which I think is, you know, they've gone overboard. I think there's way too much tree clearing, as you heard in that podcast.
Right.
You know, I just think that as I said in the podcast, I feel somewhat responsible because I used to have an argument with the USGA when I first got in business, trying to get them to remove some trees.
Uh-huh.
But you know, once it took off, then you know now it's just the thing to do everywhere, and it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah. Talking about your business, and what I find, I mean, from the first time you and I made contact, 5-6 years ago, you know, I just loved, the way you came back at me but you built your business, other than an architect, going to clubs that were sitting on Ross courses and convincing them mm-hmm. to restoring them to what they really were and making them mm-hmm. much, much greater than they were at that point. How difficult was that? Was that journey to convince clubs to really believe you and say, "Hey, Ron, I mean, make it the way it was supposed to be."
Well, you know, I never thought of it as unusually difficult. When I, you know, people weren't even using the term restoration related to golf architecture at that time. Nobody. Reese Jones had somewhat restored three holes at the Country Club in Brookline, where when I was fairly young, I used to play in a tournament there.
Mm-hmm.
And they are really a good amateur tournament. The fairways that are at the Country Club were better than the putting surfaces on any of the golf courses I grew up on. But anyway, so Reese somewhat restored three holes on that golf course at about the same time that I made my decision to go into business and focus on trying to convince these, you know, the more prominent wealthy clubs in America who really owned most of these fine old classic golf courses to consider restoration. So, you know, like everything else, it started slowly, and it was most of it was driven by people beginning to hear me speak, or there was a curiosity about what I was trying to accomplish. And a lot of these clubs, you know, my phone began to ring.
Right.
So, you know, I never have been much of a self-promoter, and it wasn't so much to some degree I didn't have a stomach for it, is what I say. But the reason I didn't have a stomach for it was I worked for 14 years with three other architects, and they were you know, terrific self-promoters, and I never, you know, it was just distasteful for me to be
right.
To be boasting about what I did or what I, you know, and it always has been. In some respects, I've been a success in several different sports that, you know, I didn't need any affirmation on what I was doing in my working career ever, you know. And I mean, I've never left a job where I felt like it wasn't something I could have done better.
Yeah, but still, it was, you know, you were a pioneer, and as with most successful pioneers, is if you build it, they will come. So thank you for that, and you know, all those places that have these wonderful, wonderful courses that are not 8,000 yards long. Even though Aronimink, as a par 70, is playing quite long. What were Ross's, when Ross laid out this golf course, was it a long golf course at the time?
No, I think we probably added 150 to 200 yards over the time. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was, well, I mean, to be honest, probably it was 6,700 or something, which was lengthy for Ross. But, you know, enough tournament tees or back tees were added to get it over to up to about 72, and then Gil Hanson's added a few more back tees. So, you know, but remember, Frank. Now a lot of these really great old early golf courses, there's just not enough room to lengthen them anyway.
Right.
You know, so that's always been a problem, and that's one of the reasons, you know, I think everybody should put more emphasis on the topographic personality or character of the putting surface. Right. I think, you know, I made a statement in that podcast that there's not a great golf course in the world that doesn't have great putting surfaces.
Exactly.
And in America, we're destroying a lot of them because we're now mowing at a tenth of an inch, which means that you know, under a 3% slope, a ball will roll forever.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so now we've got a lot of young people taking over clubs. From a management standpoint, they're members and they become president and vice president and board of directors and so forth. And we get new green committees. They really don't appreciate and understand the history of golf. So yep. It's an uphill battle. I mean, that's why when we talked initially, I encouraged you to try and convince your people not to imitate what they're doing in America.
Hmm.
I mean, certainly don't do it. Don't imitate what we're doing politically.
Oh, that's a whole different story. And we're fighting really hard not to imitate that. And that's not an easy battle. But you know, another thing about you and you know, you and I, if we put ourselves in the same generation, we're not the kind of guys that go around, you know, talking, everything was better when, you know, in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of things were good, but we are not opposed to making things better. So I appreciate that from
no, when you see that Michelangelo carved the Pieta.
Mm-hmm.
Out of marble at the age of 24. You know, I mean, there, a lot of the people that preceded us were so outstanding. My home was built in 1760, which is not old in Germany, but it's, you know, it's old for America.
Yeah.
And this home was built 5 years after Mozart was born and 10 years before Beethoven was born.
Yeah.
So that wasn't that long ago. I mean, Vincent van Gogh passed away in 1891.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, one of the things that, and if people go to that fifth episode on Feed the Ball, you'll hear a lot about why I think the way I do, but a big part of it was appreciation, really honest appreciation for the people who preceded us.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't think, you know, I don't think that's alive in a lot of people, yeah. A lot of minds today.
Well,
you know,
we're doing, you know, and when I say we, you and I, we're doing the best we can to change that. Now, coming down the stretch here on a Sunday at a major, which are the holes that you think on the back nine are going to really separate and tell the story?
I don't think there's a breather on the back nine, and it all has to do with the putting surfaces, Frank. They're all really good. Number 10 may be my favorite putting surface in the world of golf. You know, it's got a big old swale that runs through the center of the green at an angle, and I mean it was a brave thing to do to put that in the middle of a putting surface, but. Yeah, I don't know. Let me think. I think maybe it's the 13th hole that straight away is a breather, but I don't, you know, it's proving to be true that there's no breathers on the backside because the putting surfaces are so sturdy.
All right.
You know?
Is the fact that, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're in, I don't even know what month we are. Are we in May or in June? We're in May.
May.
Thank you, Ron. But May in Philadelphia is pretty early in the year. I mean, and if we look at the weather conditions, I mean, today it's a beautiful day in Philly. I mean, it's, you know, whatever, 85. The wind has played apparently an enormous factor in this tournament. Is that part
it's
of
not
the?
Normal.
It's not normal. I love the fact that we have a PGA championship where the lead on Sunday is 5 or 6 under. I love that. I hate 20 under, you know, whatever, 15 under. I don't like that. And I think that's what's given the PGA championship a bad rap. So the fact that it's early was a risk taken by the PGA that maybe we'll have.
Well, you know, I mean, it was just a happenstance because this golf course was covered with snow 2 months ago. Mm. I mean, we had a more difficult winter than we normally do here. Now, I mean, I grew up in New England, in Vermont, big part of my life. So that's what we had. What we normally have in Pennsylvania is peanuts, you know. But we had a long winter and. I mean, the leaves on the trees, really, a month ago, there were no leaves on most of these trees that you see on TV right now.
Right.
I flew out to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, came back through Charlotte, North Carolina, and we landed in Charlotte. There were leaves on all the trees. When we got up to Philadelphia, no leaves on any of the trees.
Wow.
So, yeah, so this is, it's been a late spring, and that... You know, that really hasn't hurt the golf course at all, and but the wind is a little bit unusual.
Yep.
The one thing that's this, I just want to mention one thing. I don't mean to
no, please
with a conversation here.
Please,
but,
please.
One thing that surprises me that's outstanding is that these greens are not out of control from a speed standpoint, and they do mow them very tightly.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, but there, I haven't seen anybody really putt off a green.
Right.
I don't think I've seen a ball run back and go down the approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm really surprised at that and happy about that. You know.
Right. It almost feels like a U.S. Open setup, and I don't know if that's because of the wind, but a lot of the players describe the rough leading up to the tournament as spotty, which I guess makes it so much more unpredictable. Have they?
I think the rough was pretty consistent, Frank.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they. You know, it started out about 3.5 inches on the Thursday, but now, you know, with a couple of days of good weather, warm weather, And the grass is an inch and a half higher at least.
Yeah, but
So
that wasn't that Ross's intention that if you miss a fairway, you're going to pay a price? Or if you hit a bunker, you're going to pay a price?
sure, yeah, but his fairways were enormously wide. You
Yep.
know, I'm at 150, 160, 170 feet wide normally. Now, I'm not sure what they have here, but I've always pushed them to get them out to about 120 feet wide.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, I saw a fairway this morning that was 48 feet wide from right to left, you know.
Oh.
So, and actually, on each end, it was a little bit in the rough. So probably 135 feet wide, that fairway, the first fairway.
Yep.
So I think that, which I think is really great, and it doesn't necessarily bring the rough in too much, but there's a lot of guys that are not hitting it very straight. So
Yep.
I'm not sure quite what's going on there.
Yeah.
Maybe
Well,
pressure.
it might be pressure. Ron, listen,
Yeah.
thank you so much for taking the time on a Sunday afternoon, evening.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. And thank you. It's a wonderful feeling to know that you're out there, if I can say it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I mean, Frank, you become like a brother to me over the years, and I'm in love with your two little children, and my mother's German, by the way. I think I told you that,
Yes, you
didn't
did.
I? She's
Yes, you
from
did.
Greenfield.
And we talked about the town that you're from. And we might need an intervention on my daughter's part because she's seriously considering switching out of golf into soccer. So I might have to call on you for that.
Okay. Well, I think anything's good. Anything's good. I don't know how old she is, as long as she's running and as long as she's involved with some sport. It's incredible how the women play golf today. They
Yeah.
just they
Yeah.
had an LPGA event last weekend
Yep.
on television on my golf course up in northern New Jersey. It's
Yep.
another Ross course I restored called Mountain Ridge. And I was up there on Sunday. It's phenomenal. It's
Yep.
women in sports, period. It's a great thing to see, isn't it?
Yep. Absolutely. And I think Augusta did a big part in the golf game for that
Sure.
with the Augusta women's amateur. Not making it a pro event but an amateur event,
Yeah.
and I absolutely agree with you. We had the German Amundi Masters here this week, finished today.
I watched it, yeah. I
Yeah,
didn't know who won, but I watched it this morning.
a German one. I don't know what her name is, but that
Okay.
course and that course was built by a good friend of mine, Michael Blesch, who is moving Earth like nobody I've ever seen before. But yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's a good thing. Without what do we got now? We got a lead at 5 or 6 under. You think that's going to hold, or is somebody going to break out?
No, I don't think anybody's gonna break away because every hole is a pretty sturdy test. I mean,
Yeah.
some of the ones that I didn't expect to place, like 17, I did not think that was gonna be that difficult, and that's proving to be difficult. What's astonishing to me is not many people are hitting shots, the second shots in tight to the pin, or even the par threes
Yep.
are hitting their tee shot close to the pin, which really surprises me. But
Yeah. And 17 is a
I don't
par
know.
3.
Yeah,
Is
it's a wood water. Yeah.
it a coincidence that a lot of the great courses that I know have a really tough 17th par 3? I'm thinking of Kiowa, I'm thinking of Lido, where Bethpage has a wonderful 17th par
Sure.
3. And to me that was always a sign of a great golf course. You're fighting a battle and you're going 15, 16, and then you get to 17 and you got this par 3 that's almost
Yeah.
that's a really good hole. You don't stand on the tee and say, oh my God. I mean, you say, this is a good hole.
Yeah, I think I don't think I think you want a variety of holes, right? In the home stretch, and that's I think a mix of three fours and fives is great, and you don't want three fours or something. So I think most architects it almost becomes instinctive to try to create a good finish on these golf courses, you know. And but that water that's in front of 17, that was Robert Trent Jones's work. And they were there was a big conversation at the club whether to eliminate it and push the water back away from the green, and they decided not to, which I think probably was the right decision.
Yeah. One final question. Is it true that when somebody asks an architect to build a golf course, they should never build the first hole facing east, because that's where the sun rises? Because I love golf courses that have first holes that face east, when you face the sun, right when you go on your journey.
Yeah, it never bothered me, Frank. I mean, the sun rises, you know, so it's only in your eyes at a certain hour during the morning, let's say, you know, and then it's up high enough where it's not bothering you so much. So, I never gave it much thought. And I don't think too many good architects are really much influenced by that.
There you
I mean, the first hole on this golf course is pretty interesting. I think it's one of the better golf holes on the golf course. But you know, it's you drive from a very elevated tee, and the fairway just keeps rising up and, you know, higher and higher and higher, so you almost can't. You since it's when you're in the landing area, you don't really see the entire putting surface. So really, you know, they asked me on that podcast what I thought was one of the tougher holes, and I thought the first was. So.
Yeah. Well, and in a major, number one on a Sunday is certainly probably the toughest tee shot there is, right?
Oh, sure, sure. But you know, the fairways are wide, so they don't have any excuses. And when Rory was complaining about the setup, that's a bunch of nonsense. Mm. I've never even heard anybody complain about the setup.
Well, but Scotty Scheffler said that he's never seen pin positions as difficult as he's seen in the first two rounds.
Yes, I think he made a pretty good point, but I mean, on greens like this, it's hard not to find a pin position that's difficult.
Yeah, I mean, they're fair. They're fair.
Well, they really are. I mean, I think everybody that win or lose is going to go away really feeling good about this golf course.
I
they
think
might not,
so too.
You know, someone like Scotty may not feel good about his game, because I mean, he today and yesterday, and yes, during yesterday's round, he missed five putts within 4 feet that were 4 footers or less.
Exactly. Exactly.
And he started out today and the first six holes missing two that were, you know, just gimmies, really. So,
exactly.
When he gets home, he's going to realize that, you know, he absolutely blew, you know, maybe 8 or 9 strokes that he absolutely should have had. So,
exactly.
You know.
Well, let's see. Let's watch the rest of this tournament tonight.
Yep.
And Ron, I really appreciate it. Have a great, great afternoon, evening in Philly. And thank you so much for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Pritchard, live from Philadelphia.
Yeah, thanks to all my German relatives.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Ron, have a good night. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Frank.
Good
take
night.
Care. Bye-bye.